At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
A tenacious toddler infiltrates one of the most secure places on the planet. Plus, a paralyzed man stands again. And could we be on the verge of a universal language? This is our weekly segment, Anything But Politics. I'm Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Well, admittedly, I was a little bit concerned about this segment, Anything But Politics. It's our moment during the week to take a break from the regular news cycle, take a deep breath, look at what's going on around us that's not always right in front of us. What are the stories that we should be covering or are interesting to cover that don't get top billing? Because we have a lot of really important stories happening around the world. And that's why I felt some hesitancy going into this segment, because so many of these stories that we've covered during the week continue to develop, and I don't want to miss big developments, and I want you to trust us for the big news as well. But last night I was reflecting on this, and I thought, no, this is important to actually take a break from the regular news cycle, because when we talk about the 24-hour news cycle, that's actually inaccurate. There is no 24-hour news cycle. The news cycle is infinity. It's just constant all the time. And one of the things that that does that's really negative, there's some great parts of that, which are that when we're in breaking news environments, when we really need information, the speed in which information can travel is just remarkable. Now, that's also true for information that's not factual, and we know that that can cause a problem. But I don't need to tell you that. You live in the world and you see it. But one of the things that happened in the news cycle when it was not an infinite news cycle, we would have these moments of break sort of built in throughout the day. You had your morning newspaper, you had your evening news. And during those different periods of time, and sometimes, by the way, you would have an AM edition of the paper and a PM edition of the paper, you could let go of those stories and wait to see a summary of the developments at the end of the day. And it was very clear when you learn something new. Now, when stories develop, any little thing is a development, but they're not all equal in value. So, for example, we've received a lot of the same answers from the administration on this story regarding the Atlantic and this text ring over Signal and American officials using this platform. And even if the American officials are saying the same thing, if they're saying it on a different day in a different setting, it's a development and it's news. But we're not necessarily learning more. So we're getting a flood of content and information that's not necessarily high quality. And again, there's a value to kind of watching a story develop step by step, but it also can be confusing, and it doesn't allow us that time to take a breath and step back and think about what did we really see. For example, the more and more I think about this Atlantic story, I actually think there's an angle that we're not covering. And this is Anything But Politics, and this is actually not a political angle. This is actually a really interesting angle, which is it's easy to forget when we're covering political news that these people work for us. We don't work for them. And the reason why that's important is that anything that they do, we own. So when they communicate, those records are our records. And if they're communicating on a platform that no one really realizes they're communicating on, and we don't know if that's the case there because apparently Signal is being used throughout the government, the question is, well, where do those records go? And even if the records are classified or top secret, they still go somewhere. Even if I don't have access to it, it still belongs to the public and it's archived. And that's part of this story too. Again, didn't get a lot of coverage, but is an interesting angle. And perhaps I arrived on that just because I took a second to think about it. Otherwise, I'm chasing these developments moment by moment. So I actually think it's good for us to take a little bit of a break and take a deep breath and think about some of these stories, some of which you probably saw covered this week, maybe some of them that you didn't. Just to sort of cleanse our mind, the developments will be there on these other stories. And when they are, we want to be really clear that it's new information, and we want to be very clear about why it matters and how it could potentially change the story. So I think these built-in breaks on Friday are actually important. So that's my little argument. That's my little TED talk today. Thanks for coming to it. So let's start with it. This is actually a story that got a lot of attention this week, but I'm going to take a little bit of a different twist on it. One of the most secure places on the planet is no match for a toddler. And any parent could have told you that. You leave your toddler alone just for a second. I mean, you just need to go to the bathroom, you know, something that seems so normal. And it's amazing not only where your toddler can go, but what they can get into, what sort of trouble they can get into, which is why you're never supposed to take your eyes off them. But even if you have your eyes on them, they can do strange things like slip through the fence of the White House and wind up in a secure location where they're not supposed to be. And that's what happened to a toddler this week. When I first saw this headline, I thought, wait a minute, is this an old headline? Because this actually happened in the spring in 2023, almost the same time of year. You know, have a lot of tourists in DC. You have peak bloom coming for the cherry trees. It's a beautiful time to be there. Lots of families are there. And so we actually had something similar happen a couple years ago. But no, this is a new incident. This is a new incident. We don't have a lot of information about this toddler specifically, what the family was doing, but it was evening at the White House. He slips through the fence. And of course, that just raises all sorts of questions, which is, we know, you know, toddlers are nimble, but like, how did he actually do that? And one of the other things I'm just curious about is, what about this fence? Like, is this good enough? Do we need to do something different? And that led me to think, well, what about the history of the White House fence? Because it actually has a very interesting history. For a long time in American history, you could have pretty good access to the White House. In fact, at times, some presidents realized that they were going to have to put more security measures in place because people were trying to take photos with their children, or they were coming up to the door and knocking and looking to, you know, say hello. And obviously that was a little bit of a disruption, let alone a security threat. So here's a little bit of a history of the White House fence, just because I thought this was sort of interesting to think about. So President Thomas Jefferson is the one that actually started to put a little bit of a barrier around the White House. It started with a wooden fence and then quickly moved to a low stone wall. This was very strategic. Remember, Thomas Jefferson was very strategic about architecture. He did not want views to be impeded. So he didn't want a big fence around the White House, but he wanted enough of a barrier to keep the livestock to keep the livestock away from the front door of the White House. So he put this stone wall in place that actually survived for several decades, right up until about the 1830s. In the 1830s, we start seeing the use of an iron gate. And so now we're starting to move to not what it looks like today, but more of that feeling of something that looks a little bit more serious. So 1830s iron gate. Now we're going to move towards the Civil War, the assassination of President Lincoln. Now you have President Grant in office, and he's getting a little bit more concerned. So he expands the fence. He's also expanding the grounds around the White House, what he's considering this is our White House property. And the fence expands there. But from my reading of it from the White House Historical Association, it appears that people could still enter the grounds. They just had to leave at night. And then it was really up to every other following president to decide how they actually wanted to police the grounds. It wasn't just a universal thing. So different presidents had different ways of looking at security around the White House. Again, many of them encountered their own problems or their own challenges and then adjusted because of that. For example, their child being asked for a photograph or something to that extent. It was really around World War I, World War II, where we're starting to see security, again, look a little bit more modern. We're seeing the fence line expand. When you see the old photos, though, of the White House, you realize that the previous fences weren't really tall. And in fact, they weren't really tall until really around modern times. So although the perimeter became more secure over the last 100 years, meaning that we had maybe more barriers put into place, or the street was closed off to traffic, or pedestrians were limited in certain areas in front of the fence actually stayed relatively low. It wasn't like this big, tall, imposing fence. That changed in 2015. So in 2015, there were these anti-climb features, these metal spikes. They could be temporary. So you could put them on, you could take them off. Apparently, that's how it's described. It looks like they're probably left on there, though. It was something that you could put on that had pretty serious spikes to deter people hopping the fence. Again, the fence is low. So then we moved to solve that problem in 2019. In 2019, so we're getting into the Trump administration. This was approved actually before, about the year he came into office. The fence around the White House grows to 13 feet tall. So it doubles in size. But here's what happens when it doubles in size. The length between the spikes, I was talking about the spikes at the top. I don't know exactly what to call. I need a fence maker here on call. So you have an iron gate or a steel now. It's a steel gate because it needs to be stronger so that a car can't smash through it. Okay, so we change the material. We make it real tall so you can't hop over it. We got the spikes on the top. But between each metal spike or the lines in the fence, for lack of a better word, it became a little wider. So it went from about 4 inches to about 5 inches between each line in the fence. And so think about 5 inches. I mean, it's not very big, but could you have like a little toddler head kind of fit through that. Maybe that's part of the reason we're seeing that young children can fit through it. It got a little bit more spacious in between and the toddlers can slip through. We've seen that happen twice. So I don't know if this will change anything. I don't think the toddler was a threat. I mean, it depends. Probably disruptive, a little bit distracting, especially if you're having a serious meeting, but not necessarily a security threat, but it brings up a question about the fence. So interesting to note, the grounds around the White House have changed over the years, and there was a recent change that we have to ask the question, did that make it more likely for young children to fit through the fence? A burning question that we will investigate further at Smarter News. Okay, another study I just wanted to put in front of you, another story, I should say, is about a small study. And I want to preface this. This is a very small study. There's very limited research. This research is not peer-reviewed. These are all things that we look at to say, hey, this is a really crazy study, like really groundbreaking. But it's the fact that there's been a development here that seems astonishing that I just wanted to flag for you. So it's a small study out of Japan using stem cells, and it has reportedly produced what previously many thought would be a miracle, helping a paralyzed person stand again. So let me just read to you. I'm reading from an article in Nature, and this is what it says. A paralyzed man can stand on his own after receiving an injection of neural stem cells to treat his spinal cord injury. The Japanese man was one of four individuals in a first-of-its-kind trial that used reprogrammed stem cells to treat people who are paralyzed. Okay, wait a second. What are reprogrammed stem cells? It goes on. Reprogrammed stems are created by reverting adult cells to an embryonic-like state from which they can be coaxed to develop into other cell types. So coaxed to develop into a way that can be healing for the body. One thing to note is researchers, so inject these individuals, there's four paralyzed people, and we don't have too many details on them right now. And we don't know, you know, how similar are their injuries. That would be a really interesting thing to find a little bit more about. I'd like to reach out to the researchers here, in fact. So 1 year after this study takes place, the researchers say they did not observe any serious adverse effects. And that here's sort of the breakdown of the four people. So you have two of the participants that did not show improvements at all to their ability to feel or move in the lowest section of their spinal cord. One individual moved up in classification in the period after surgery, so can move some of their arm and leg muscles, but cannot stand on their own. Another individual improved to a level D. Normal function is classified as E and can stand independently. This is a quote from one of the researchers. That person is now training to walk. This is a dramatic recovery. So 25%, let's take a look, right? 25%, one out of four saw these remarkable results. We don't know if it can be repeated, but a fascinating enough headline to ask questions about what's next in this research. And again, something to have on our radar of what could be truly remarkable, that someone with an injury could recover to the point, a severe injury, where they can't walk, they can't move like they normally did or previously did in their life. And then they're able to receive these reprogrammed stem cells and stand and potentially walk again. We should watch this body of research. Could be a huge breakthrough. Wanted to flag it for you. And finally, this is a report to watch. You know, I'm always hesitant in the regular news cycle. I want everything on the record. I don't like reports on reports on reports. However, because we're coming up on the summer, there's going to be a lot of people traveling. And, you know, it's easy to fall victim to a miscommunication, even when we speak the same language as someone, right? I mean, it's very easy to do. And then you go to a foreign country and you make all sorts of mistakes. You can't really communicate. You get yourself into trouble. I remember studying abroad in Spain, a lot of really silly mistakes that I found myself in embarrassing situations. Just this past summer, I was in a rural part of France and I forgot my son's eardrops. And I had to go to a doctor on the weekend, which, by the way, is not easy to do in France, let alone rural France. And thank goodness we had Google Translate, because I could actually have the name of the medication translated and I was able to access it. But honestly, without that, I don't know what would have happened. So there's a couple reasons why I just wanted to, again, flag this report. It's only a report, and it originally comes from a Bloomberg journalist, Mark Gurman, who is taking a look at Apple. Apparently, Apple is working on a real-time translation feature for their AirPods. So these earphones that a lot of people walk around with on a regular basis. So let's say someone is speaking Spanish to me. I have my AirPods in, and as they're speaking in real time, I am hearing them in English. And that apparently there could be another component where if I have my phone and then I start speaking, my phone will say to them in Spanish what I'm saying in real time. I mean, pretty amazing, right? Now, I don't have a Google phone, but apparently Google has tried this in their Pixel Buds a couple years ago. But in general, this technology clearly has been inconsistent. Otherwise, we would all have this already. So the question is, if Apple, because Apple really dominates such a huge portion of the smartphone market, if this is something that they're able to do with this new operating system that apparently they're going to try to launch by the end of the year, then what a tool. But also, then I'm thinking about my kids learning another language, going to Spanish classes, studying abroad. You know, what happens there? It is interesting when you start thinking or dreaming or telling jokes in another language, there are parts of your mind that start opening up in a way that is hard to explain. It's really special. And we don't want to take that away. But also, if you're in some sort of an emergency, this is pretty great. Now, the question I have is can this new Apple Translate actually just work for people speaking the same language? For example, can they have like a program for husbands? So when your wife says something to you, you hear what she really means rather than what you think she's saying. Like it's like a do, 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 do. This is what she's really saying and vice versa. I mean, maybe that's what we should develop. You know, smarter translation. I mean, why stop with language? Why stop with different language? Let's just talk about what's going on in our own language and own miscommunication. All right, just a couple, again, interesting different stories to put on your radar this week in our segment, Anything But Politics, because by the end of the week, we need to talk about everything but politics. And that's what we like to do here at Smarter News. Just looking at the news, quick, concise, nonpartisan, and also adding a little something extra at the end of your week to remind us that the world is a remarkable place. It's fascinating. And there's a great deal to be curious about and amazed by. So thanks for being on this journey with us. And I look forward to seeing you next week with some of the big headlines. Have a great weekend.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.